Hey, folks, it's John Suntress from Word Balloon here with a quick announcement before we get to today's show. This is from November of 2005. It's an interview with John Ostrander, and it was an episode that was part of my original RSS feed that never made it to my Libsyn files, so I finally dug it up and wanted to post it. A lot of fans have been asking for this show. I'm happy to present it now, but this was back in the days when I kind of didn't know what I was doing as far as the balance, so John is a little bit lower than I think the balance has been in the last 2 years or so. In addition to that, this was in my old apartment, and I got bleed on my phone line, very faintly, but it was there, of one of the FM radio stations in town. Drove me crazy. Unfortunately, I didn't get a K-filter for my phone line until a few months later, so some of these 2005 interviews that I did for my house do have a little bit of phone residue. My apologies. It's kind of like if there's a TV on while we're talking. So, you know, you'll definitely hear a little bit of background noise, but it really is way in the back. But because of that, I just wanted to let you know what was going on. So enjoy this conversation with Ostrander. We're talking about Grimjack, Suicide Squad, you know, really neat stuff. And, of course, his work on Star Wars, I believe, too, probably comes up in the conversation. There's a newer Ostrander interview in my New York Comic Con 2009 coverage. I did a video interview with him and Jan Doorsma. But if you want to hear that, that is also available in audio form, and it's in video at the Newsarama website. But this is our first conversation from 2005, and if you miss the old Word Balloon theme, here's a little treat. Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation site. This is John Suntress. In the early 80s, at the dawn of the independent comic boom, Chicago's John Ostrander created a new kind of hero that clicked with readers, Grimjack. The series propelled Ostrander to the mainstream, where he put new spins on books like Hawkman and The Spectre. John also updated the Suicide Squad, creating a supervillain team whose design and plot themes live on in the current DC universe. Our conversation begins with a look at John's recent work at Dark Horse on Star Wars. How long have you been writing Star Wars for Dark Horse?
Oh, Lordy, it seems like a long, long time ago that I started in a galaxy far, far away. But I figure, was it 4 years maybe, 3-4 years?
You're writing Star Wars Republic.
Yes, I am.
From the looks of issue 78, your story picks up right after Revenge of the Sith. Now you're in that period between films 3 and 4. Are there any type of barriers that you're getting from Lucasfilms in terms of where you can go in stories and where you can't, given the fact that the television series is now in production, covering the same time period?
Well, first of all, you know, Republic is going to be ending fairly soon.
Okay.
You know, around, I think, issue 82, 83. So Republic will no longer be an ongoing. Dark Horse is using next year, which is their 20th anniversary, to launch a whole bunch of new Star Wars projects. And while I'm not yet at liberty to talk about mine, if we'd remained right where we were, yes, I think there would have been problems that we would have run up, you know, against continuity. It's always a problem when you're working with, as we say, the extended universe. It's a licensed property, while at the same time they're creating their main storyline. You know, like you're always going to rub up against things, and so the question is, how do you finesse it? You know, how do you tell gripping, exciting, suspenseful stories, and at the same time, don't trot on anybody's toes, particularly George Lucas's toes?
And I would say you succeed because it is a big enough universe where you can tell individual stories about members of the, you know, members of the fleet, as you did in 78.
Yeah.
You tell a great story. It's funny, at the in episode 3, Anakin says the line, "You're either for us or against us," evoking words from a current world leader. And in your issue in 78, it kind of felt like, you know, the beginnings of, in some cases, Nazi Germany, in some cases, maybe the same kind of feeling that people had during the Red Scare of the 50s, in terms of, again, you're either, you know, with us or against us.
Well, and the use of fear, you know, like as a political tool, which I think is certainly within the Star Wars storyline, because certainly by the time that we see it when Luke comes on years later, there's controlling through fear. The whole point of the Death Star is to complete this rule of fear. Whether or not all of George's parallels are intentional or not, or just, you know, it's in keeping with what he's established already in Star Wars, is open, I think, to the individual. I wouldn't be surprised myself, and yes, I prefer to see it that way.
You know, the great thing, too, is this was a great one-shot. You've always excelled at telling good stories and detailed, dense stories in small spaces. I mean, Grimjack itself obviously started as a backup.
Well, I've honed my skills, essentially, on the 8-pager, not only with Grimjack, but also with its backup feature at the time, Munden's Bar. And then we were doing things in that horror anthology, Wasteland, that we did from D.C. as well. Those were all eight-pagers. And you really, when you do a good eight-pager, you have to tell a really good story, and you have to be really focused in terms of what you're telling. So your storytelling skills are really on display there. If you have them, then it's just a matter of expanding outwards. But I've always tried to make sure that I put a lot of story within the space I've got, and yet at the same time try not to be confusing. I like what I call a rich broth, but you know, like, I don't want something that's muddy either. It's nice, too, in terms of 78, which, while it stands alone, the character showed up earlier. And, in fact, the first storyline that he showed up in, which was called Honor and Duty and predated the Clone Wars, I believe is going to be gathered together with this single story in order to form a single trade paperback later on.
Oh, that's great. You touched on Munden's Bar and Grimjack and Wasteland as well. Let's jump into that. I'm very curious in terms of, first of all, Grimjack's beginnings. I mean, it's a great series because you, Tim Truman, Tom Sutton, Tom Mandrake, a lot of you guys, and maybe not in the case of Tom, but Truman and Mandrake and yourself, very early in your careers, and you guys came at that time when the indies really exploded in the 80s.
Yeah.
And it immediately clicked, and I mean, it was one of the books that, you know, the indie books that everybody really wanted to get and jump onto.
Yeah, which was really, you know, like a lot of fun. And largely happened, A, because First Comics was out of Evanston at the time, and I was living up in Rogers Park at the time, so I was
stone's
always
throw away.
There.
Yeah, you're just blocks away from their offices.
Yeah, I'm an old down Chicago boy. So I was always, I was often as I could manage it, you know, I was in the offices, you know, and so I knew what they were, you know, I knew when they were about to expand, and I knew they were looking for stuff. And I had a sense of what I thought they might be looking for, and so I dusted off the character that I originally was going to do as a series of novels or prose short stories, and then readapted him for what I wanted to do there, because the original concept was somewhat different. But the whole genesis of Grimjack was because I wanted to combine genre forms. I love playing around with that. I love narrative to begin with. I love the story.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of blending the idea of sword and sorcery along with the hard-boiled detective just really tickled me. And so that was really the genesis of Grimjack. I wanted to create a hard-boiled barbarian, in other words.
And you succeeded. It was a great character and a great run. I mean, this is a significant run.
Oh, yeah.
The life of First Comics, you know, there was always a Grimjack there.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we came on, you know, really early on in terms of, I mean, there were a couple of other books obviously out before us, but once Star Slayer moved over to First, you know, Grimjack appeared very shortly thereafter in the backup. In fact, at the time when they, it's kind of funny because I'd written up the proposal for Grimjack and submitted it, and at the time they're going, well, it's fascinating stuff, but God, it's an older character. He's so grim. He's so gritty. At that time, no one was doing that. You know, the phrases were actually coined at the time to talk about Grimjack. So they said, well, we'll try him off for a year or two as a backup feature and see if he goes anywhere. Well, less than 6 months later, you know, I'm told, buckle down, boyo, because you're about to go into your own book.
And it was great because, you know, again, Tim Truman, a guy that had been rejected, I think, early on by DC?
Yeah, somewhat rejected. Also, Tim just didn't like... Tim can be ornery sometimes, and all of us who know him and love him, you know, and he admits to it, but, you know, like, he's very particular in terms of creators' rights. He didn't want to do just something that we just sign over everything, so he decided to take his butt over, and he'd go off and work for TSR, but he didn't want to work for comics so long as the deal was as it was. First was offering a different deal, and very shortly after he came on board, what with everything that was flowing out of his pen, I mean, you just saw the stories. You know, I saw all of the sketches, all of the promo arts that he was coming up with, mm-hmm. And stuff, and characters that he created for it. So I went back and I adjusted the contract in order to list him as co-creator.
That's cool.
Because I said, you know, like, this is just right. I mean, Tim put so much into it, you know, like, and really, you know, it would not have succeeded as it did, I think, without Tim at the start.
Well, and as you say, a great blend of, you know, crime noir along with fantasy and a touch of sci-fi, and just an amazing environment that lent itself not only to stories about Grimjack, but again, as you mentioned, the backup feature, Munden's Bar.
Yeah.
And you and I share memories of the inspiration for Munden's Bar, a great bar that was on Chicago's northwest side. The Bucket of Suds.
Bucket of Suds. Oh, Lordy, I love that place.
And what an amazing place. I mean, you know, yeah, you got, you know, I mean, you're a fine writer, just like Munden's Bar. This connect, it was like Rick's Cafe. Every walk of life was coming to the Bucket of Suds.
Yeah, we actually put, when I was doing Hawkman, or Hawkworld, rather.
Yes.
And we had the characters set in Chicago. I did. I had the characters out of uniform visiting the Bucket at one point. And I had a friend of mine, since I wasn't living in Chicago at that point, but actually go in, and he was glad to do so because it was another excuse to go to the Bucket, and he took pictures of everyone, including Joe, told him why. And so for two pages, you know, you were actually in the Bucket, and Joe loved it so much that I managed to get the original art for those pages, and I gave them to Joe, and he had them framed up on, over the bar. I was very flattered by that.
Yeah, Joe Dano, who was also known to Chicago radio audiences as the jazz philosopher.
Yeah.
Great guy, an amazing guy. And, you know, John, honestly, I was like, you know, the people that managed to get to Studio 54, I hate to use a cheesy, you know, analogy. By the time I got to the Bucket, I think the glory days had gone. Joe would only open it up for special occasions because of all the friends he had at WXRT, one of the rock stations in Chicago. And it was great because we did get to take Peter Gabriel to the Bucket. And,
and
the guys from Squeeze got to go to the Bucket.
Oh, amazing.
So, you know, that's the thing. And I know that Mike Gold mentioned, and I want to say in either the miniseries or in the trade for Grimjack, how Scorsese, during Color of Money. Tell the story.
Yeah. Yeah, from what I'm told, Martin Scorsese walks into is brought to the Bucket, and he walks in, and he just looks around and says, "I got to tell Francis about this." And Francis being, of course, Francis Ford Coppola.
Yeah, great, just a great hangout, as you and Mike have said, of like bikers and radio people and play people. And you were an actor, obviously, before you started writing for First.
Oh, yeah.
And a playwright.
Yeah.
Which theater group in Chicago were you with?
I went through a whole bunch of them. I started the Organic Theater with Stuart Gordon for a while.
Cool.
Peripherally. I wasn't an official member, but I did co-write Bloody Bess, which was done there. In fact, Bloody Bess was Michael was an old friend of mine, but he came and saw Bloody Bess, and he loved Bloody Bess to the point where he came to see it lots and lots of times, and that's what convinced him that maybe I could write comics as well.
Munden's Bar, the concept of it, was co-created by an amazing guy in comedy, both in Chicago and really worldwide, given his influence, is the great Del Close.
Oh, Del Close, yeah.
Talk about your collaborations with Del Close. And I mean, I do want to hit Wasteland on its own subject, but at first with Munden's Bar. Yeah, how did Del come to write a comic book?
Well, first of all, you know, I met Del when I was doing Christmas Carol, because he was at the time doing the Ghost of Christmas Present.
Okay.
And absolutely spectacular.
What were you in Christmas Carol?
I was all the big parts, like Fred's Friend Number 3, Mr. Round, Dancing Man, and Ensemble.
Okay. Carrying the spear.
Yes, my job consisted of diving in and out of costumes and walking across stage. In fact, Christmas Carol was my last acting gig, because I'd started writing comics at that point, and after diving in and out of costumes and walking across the stage trying to be in character in the moment, one little part of my brain, as I was doing this, going, you know, you could be making a lot more money at your typewriter right now. And when I got off, I said, I've just retired from the stage. But anyways, Del and I were actually shared a dressing room. And now, all I knew about Del at this point was all the stories, of course, that everyone tells about Del. The Del Close stories that go throughout, you know, anywhere where you gather with two or three people, they tell Del Close stories.
Well, there's one in particular that I'm curious about that I stumbled on your message board, and that's Del's association with the space program in its early days.
Oh, yeah. Del, first of all, when I first met him, he was living at a hole in the wall, literally, in the basement, across from Second City.
Right.
To the point where I would go over there and work with him, and as he would himself claim, you know, he spent all his money on dope and science fiction. I used the bathroom in his place once. I was too afraid to ever use it again. But he loved just the concept of comics, you know?
Sure.
And he said it was a great American art form. One born here in America that had yet to have its first masterpiece written. And so he was just intrigued as hell by the idea of it. So I started to put together actually the idea of, because Mike Gold told me, you know, we had to have a backup because there's only so many pages that Tim could draw a month and stay anywhere near sane.
Mm-hmm.
And Tim was doing a lot of work at the time. So we needed an A-page backup, and we didn't have one. And we were coming up, and I said, well, why don't we set stories in the bar, in Monday's bar? Mm-hmm. We'll do like an anthology thing, different artists every month. And Mike wasn't sure about this. He went, oh, that kind of stuff never sells. You know, and so I said, no, it'll be great. He said, I don't know. I said, what if I could get Del Close to co-write? And that sucker punched Mike. Because Mike was fascinated with Del. So I approached Del with it, and he was all for it.
Wow. And you know? And again, for people who don't know who Del Close is, this is a guy who was tied so closely to Second City, both as a performer and as a writer and a teacher.
Yeah, I think that even more than anything else, it's probably as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, certainly as a director, and then he went on to what's known as the Improv Olympics as well.
Yes.
And the list of people who he taught and influenced, I mean, lordy, you know, it's just a raft of names.
Yeah, John Belushi.
John Belushi.
Dan Aykroyd.
John Candy, Bill Murray.
And then at Improv Olympic, guys like Tim Meadows, Chris Farley, and Mike Myers.
Yeah, absolutely.
So generations of comedy coming through Chicago, and even guys, even just for a quick cup of coffee in Chicago, guys like Jon Favreau and Vince Vaughn,
yeah.
All these guys really sought Del out and you know, learned from him, and he was really one of the masters of teaching comedic improv.
Oh, absolutely. The real thing that needs to be emphasized at some point, you know, somebody needs to do a real work on it, showing just how influential Del was and is in terms of comedy in America,
mm-hmm.
because his fingerprints are all over it, you know, in terms of the influence that he's had on certain people and that they will have thereafter on other people, the things that he taught that they picked up and are carrying on, including myself to some degree as well. You know, it was the classes I took with Del were some of the most liberating classes I've ever had just in writing. It just opened me up in terms of thinking.
Wow. And if you remember, can you tell the story about Del and the space program?
Oh, yeah. Del used to like tell the story, and I got to be careful because I can slip into Del real easy, you know. You know, and we wind up, you know, with Del possessing me. But it was in the early days of the space program. And they were still doing experiments to try to figure out what sort of personality would work well in these closed capsules. Would it be an introvert or an extrovert? Introverts, they had plenty of, but NASA had to advertise for the extroverts. So they, of course, advertised for, like, actors. And one of the studies was being done in New York City when Del was there as an actor, and he saw a notice up on the board, on the call board, wanted for space exploration experiment, must be willing to take drugs. Del was there in a shot. And LSD was the drug of experimental choice at that time. This is before it became, you know, the recreational drug that it later became.
Right.
So they basically give Del LSD and then put him into a sensory deprivation chamber.
Go ahead.
And as far as Del's concerned, he's rocketing through the universe, man. He's having a great time. Until... at some point, they raise the lid, and this bright light comes in, and this voice goes, what do you want for lunch, and hands in a menu. And he's looking at the menu, and the letters are getting up and running around the page. And then he lights on what he thinks are the three funniest words suddenly in the in the English language, which is tuna salad sandwich. He goes, tuna salad sandwich, blah! You know, and the hand goes, okay, and pulls out, you know, like, closes it. You know, he's in darkness again, rocketing through the cosmos. And then at some undefined point later, it opens again, the light comes in comes the hand with a plate and a sandwich going, here's your tuna, and salad sandwich, which. Well, considering that, as far as he knew, he had just been served lunch by God, he figured that was it. And he never went back for, like, his second... And, he says he still owes them.
Nothing could top getting the metaphysical sandwich from the Lord.
I know.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, although, you know, it should be pointed out, if we're telling Del stories, you know, you might as well tell the final true Del story.
Please.
You know, which is, you know the story of Del's will.
Yes.
And Del's skull.
Absolutely.
After Del died, By the way, his final birthday was, Bill Murray made sure that it was held in the basement of the hospital where Dell was at the time. And Bill Murray was hosting it and stuff. So, and Dell had, was asked what he wanted to drink. He said, well, I've never had a white chocolate martini. I want to try that. So they gave him some. And, shortly thereafter he dies. And in his will, he wills his skull to the Goodman Theater for use in plays such as Hamlet, particularly as York, with the understanding that he has to get a credit and a bio in the program.
So but generations will be able to enjoy Del Close's work.
Yeah. My first reaction on hearing this was, Del, you're dead. You don't have to pad the resume any further. But they did it. They detached the skull. They cleaned it. And in a ceremony at a bar, China Halperin, who was his business partner in the Improv Olympics, turned it over to Bob Falls. And so far as I know, Del's skull is in the prop room of the Goodman Theater.
Last I heard, it is there, so that's pretty cool. No, an amazing guy. And beyond Munden's Bar, you guys collaborated on Wasteland.
Yeah.
And I saw that he considered Wasteland really the only true autobiography of his life.
It's the only time he ever did biographical writing on himself. Granted, the stories are somewhat mixtures. Del felt the truth was always a good starting point, but he was not above making the story better. If it meant that he had to add in something like a perpetual motion machine, well, okay, he'd be willing to do that. But a lot of the stories were true. Even some of the most bizarre-sounding ones were, in fact, true.
Like the roller skating in the Chicago sewers, shooting rats with a flashlight on his head?
Yeah. Dale actually objected. He said, only an idiot would go through that with, like, a flashlight on his head. It was actually a miner's cap.
Okay.
Miner's hat. Hard hat.
Even
we got
better.
The details wrong.
All right. Have they collected Wasteland?
No.
That's a shame. That really is a shame. And
yeah.
for the Chicago audience alone, yeah. That would really appreciate it, because Del is revered still in Chicago and certainly by his friends such as yourself, and I think that would really be a nice tribute.
Del originally wanted to call it Misogynistic Funnies. And we had to talk him out of it. We said, no, you don't understand. We want to basically alienate people after they've bought the book, not before. And considering that our publisher was a woman, we don't want her canceling the book before it comes out.
Was it a Vertigo book?
No, it wasn't.
Because I thought you were going to maybe
was just getting started at the time.
I was thinking you might say Karen Berger.
No, Berger, I think, would have gone along with it.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to say.
No, it was Jeanette Kahn.
Okay.
We were worried about at the time.
I understand.
Evidently, Jeanette read the first issue and never read another one. Gold always said that if we were successful, because it was a horror anthology, but a very psychological, twisted horror, which again tickled Bell. If he was trying to tell his biography, he wanted it to be part of a horror story anthology.
Well, it was very Burroughs in its approach. It really was, and certainly Dell was part of that that group, and I think that mindset.
Yeah.
So very cool. Really, really cool. Back to Grimjack. So
okay.
After years of legal wrangling, you were able to bring it back. How was the response? The miniseries just wrapped up. I enjoyed it. You felt like you were going back home, but also in fresh ways as well.
Well, yeah, we actually constructed that story very carefully because we had a couple of different, almost competing agendas going on with it. We wanted to certainly, first of all, satisfy all the old readers who've been waiting.
A large community of readers that have been waiting
and
that you've supported, or I should say, you've stayed in contact with on the web.
Yeah, and who basically, I wasn't lying when I wrote that not a month went by when people didn't ask me, when is Grimjack coming back, throughout the 13 years. It was
certainly.
Like amazing. So we wanted to please them. We also wanted to make it accessible to new readers.
Mm-hmm.
We also wanted to do it so there was a complete story in and of itself, so it could be gathered into a trade paperback. And our guy out in Hollywood is now going to use the trade paperback when it comes out in an effort to try to sell it to the movies. So it also had to be the sort of story that might interest movie makers. So, we had a couple of different goals in mind when we're doing it. And I'm pleased to say, I think that it worked out real nice. One of the things that I was really worried about was when I went to script it, would Grimjack's voice still be there for me? And boom, it's like just opening the taps again.
That's great.
Yeah, it was just amazing. It's like Grimjack, John Grant was just waiting there and going, well, I've been here. Where you been?
And it felt that way. It really did. And I also like the fact that you, in the first trade, re-releasing the old stories as well, had the wraparound as well of John Gaunt sitting down and kind of, telling his tales.
Yeah.
The mini in itself is a prequel to the series.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I think would make it work, because it told a story that the old fans didn't, there were various allusions to things that hadn't been in it, mm-hmm. but we never fully explored it before.
Yes.
So it gave them information that they had never had before, and yet at the same time it almost works in many ways as an origin story
sure.
for how he becomes the Grimjack that we know from the regular stories.
Mm-hmm.
On that level, I think it works both for the old reader and new reader at the same time.
And are there plans for more miniseries to come?
Yeah, we very much want to do some more. Tim Truman's tied up doing some Conan work for Dark Horse right
okay.
now, and he'll be tied up probably until at least the first quarter is over next year. He's doing a miniseries and some fill-in issues. I've seen some of the stuff, and talk about somebody who is born to draw Conan.
That would be cool. Yeah, who's writing that?
Joe Lansdale's writing the miniseries.
Oh, that's terrific.
And Kurt Busiek is the writer on the regular series.
So he'll be drawing for both of them.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. It's nice to see him back with Joe as well.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, Truman's got two twins. I'm his good twin. Lansdale is his evil twin. I sometimes said that Truman is my evil twin. Well, Lansdale is his evil twin.
And is where's Mandrake in this triad with you and Tim Truman? Tom Mandrake.
Tom came on after Sutton and stuff, and mm-hmm. We will eventually be reprinting Tom's stuff.
Cool.
As well, and I would love to see Tom get another chance to draw some Grimjack as well. Tom and I are, Tom lives near me. So we're in contact all the time.
That's cool.
And we're trying to put some new projects out there as well. We got a couple of ideas and some nibbles on it. So Tom and I definitely want to work together again.
Very cool. I wanted to get into some of your other DC work, mm-hmm. and Mike Gold, you and Mike Grell, the three of you guys at DC really did some fun, interesting stuff. Beyond Wasteland, let's go back to Suicide Squad.
Ah.
A great concept, and one that I think DC has dusted off and represented as things like Villains United.
Yeah. Yeah. At the time, it was kind of odd because I went in wanting to do Challengers of the Unknown.
Okay.
And but that was tied up with somebody else. And so the editor I was working with said, well, here, why don't you try Suicide Squad? This is Bob Greenberger.
Okay.
I said, Suicide Squad? He said, yeah, you have carte blanche. Do anything you want with it. I said, yeah, but who in their right mind belongs to something they call themselves Suicide Squad? And then suddenly a little bell went off my head, and the answer came, people who have no other choice. Okay, who would have no other choice? Criminals. Dirt dozen using superheroes working for the government. I think I could write that.
And it took off. I mean, I was one of those first readers, and it came at the right time. It was, in that post-crisis era where I think people were looking for grit and grimmer stories. And you had this great adventure story with the, juxtaposition of the villains being the heroes. And
one of the things I wanted to do was to establish that these villains, sometimes in wacky-looking costumes, could actually be very dangerous individuals if left on their own.
Mm-hmm.
So in Squad, you would see them being dangerous, so that when next you would see the superhero having to deal with them, you'd go, okay, this guy isn't just a pushover, because if they are, then the superheroes are just bullies. But if they're capable and dangerous characters on their own right, well, okay, then that ups the stakes when the other people deal with them.
And the best example of that in the book, and I'm sure he was the fan favorite, was Captain Boomerang.
One of my favorites.
And I was so sorry to see him go away in Infinite Crisis, or I should say Identity Crisis.
Yeah.
Because you gave him a great voice that I think would work even better now as a middle-aged character.
Yeah.
But talk about, he really came alive. And wonderful writers had their opportunities with Captain Boomerang, Kerry Bates, mm-hmm. and all the guys who wrote The Flash. And it seems like you're the guy that really kind of tilted him in the right way to really make him just come alive.
Well, I was influenced. It's interesting because originally people, again, Bobby Greenberger suggested, oh, by the way, Captain Boomerang's available. I said, oh, great, Captain Boomerang's available. he's got this idiot little hat, and talk about your total loser character.
And he throws boomerangs. Oh, how dangerous. So what I got into instead was, okay, what's his character? What makes him tick? You know, he comes from Australia, all the rest of it. And I decided, okay, I got influenced by a series of novels by George MacDonald Fraser called, with a character called Flashman. And it's a brilliant series. Flashman was originally a minor, nasty little bug character in an old Victorian novel called Tom Brown's School Days. George MacDonald Fraser dusted him off, picked him up from the point where he was kicked out of Tom Brown's School Days. And the character is an unremitting bounder, cad, coward, who somehow always manages to come out on top. And I said, what a fun character. And I said, okay, I'm going to make Captain Boomerang that character.
Wow.
He never reforms. You know, like every time you think that you've explored a lower level for him to sink to, he finds another one to go to. You know, like, there is no nobility in him whatsoever. You know, there's a smart mouth, and one of my favorite things that we did in Suicide Squad was we had this incredibly long-running subplot of throwing pies in the face. And Captain Boomerang was actually the second one to get the pie in the face, and he was all indignant. But it turns out in the end that he's actually the one throwing the pies in the face, and he actually pied himself with a pie boomerang, or a boomerang pie, you know,
sure.
so as to take the suspicion off of him. And it had the readers just guessing like crazy. It's the fans nuts trying to figure out who it was.
that's the thing. It had both the danger vibe to it, but also the humor side of things like Justice League as well.
Yeah.
And you know, it was a great combination.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we figured, you know, like, I mean, you got to have the one-liners and stuff like that. Grimjack is always good for that, too.
Sure.
Yeah, you know, however dark and grim and gritty we got. People forget is that there's this incredible dark sense of humor. Even Wasteland, you know, like, lots
Absolutely.
Of humor. Gold once described it as the black hole of humor from which no laughter escapes. But, I always feel it's important. If it's all one thing or the other, then the reader gets complacent and doesn't know what's going to happen next.
Sure.
Also, when we would kill off certain characters, we really killed them off. We took the character who was seemingly like the lead character, Rick Flagg, and when we killed him off, readers just go, oh, what?
Right.
Wait a minute. He's the hero. Isn't he the star? No, he's dead now. But he could come back, right? And I said, no, he was at ground zero when a nuke went off. I think he's dead. Baked.
No, and you know, this is a guy that went back to the 50s, Task Force X.
Yeah. Yeah, the original Suicide Squad.
Right, yeah.
You know, so he's my continuity with that, and I blew him up darn good. What it did was set notice to everyone reading the book is that, yeah, I could kill off anybody here.
Anything can happen.
Yeah, you know, like, don't take him for granted, you know. Yes, it did develop that certain characters I obviously wasn't going to kill off. Boomerang being one, Deadshot being another, and Amanda Waller, you know, who I loved. You know.
Right, the counterweight to the group, because who else could keep them in line but a bulldozer of a person like Amanda Waller?
The Wall.
Yeah. The Wall, exactly. And again, a character that has found new life in animated form.
Yeah.
And was quite an interesting character on the Justice League animated series.
Yeah, and no one like her existed in comics, period, before we did her.
Yep.
A tough, no-nonsense black woman, you know, who could stare down Batman.
Absolutely.
By the way, I love the episodes that she was in, and they got the right voice for her and everything.
Yeah, I forget who the actress was who played her. I don't know if you know.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. She's on the, I think it's the one who's on the badge.
Oh, yes, CeCe.
The Shield?
Yes, I know. Yeah, as soon as you said it. Yeah, The Shield. CeCe, and I forget her last name.
Pounder.
Yes, CeCe Pounder.
CeCe Pounder, yeah.
And she is. She is perfect for Amanda Waller.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, she can play her for real.
Absolutely. So how many of the group? I mean, you know, you said Bob was the one who suggested Boomerang. Who else in the group did you want or were suggested to you?
Well, I said, I just wanted Dylan. Mm-hmm. Bob said, no, you got to have some heroes in there in order to counterweight him.
But you picked great third-level heroes and gave them new life, like the Bronze Tiger out
there. Yeah. Yeah, again, nobody wanted them. You know, yeah, we took, you know, I mean,
this was your Dirty Dozen.
Well, yeah, I, in many ways, I mean, if you take a look at my career, particularly DC, my specialty is in taking characters that no one else really wanted or knew really what to do with, and I could find something to do with them.
I agree. Well, yes, definitely. You gave new life to Hawkman. I do want to talk about the Spectre later, your Martian Manhunter run as well.
Yeah.
No, I can see that. And, you know, Suicide Squad was just an entertaining book, an incredible book. And
yeah, it gave me the chance to do just about anything I wanted with it, you know.
And everybody seemed to show up in there at some point as well, as far as the rest of the DC Universe.
Yeah. Two of my favorite lunatics were Punch and Julie, who would come in and out.
Absolutely. Yeah. Let's talk about the Spectre. A great run, you and Tom Mandrake, and, you know, the Spectre had some classic runs, Neil Adams' work on it, Murphy Anderson and Michael Fleischer and Jim Aparo had that great run in the 70s, too. And yours came along about 10 years after that and seemed to marry all the what made, you know, the previous incarnations good in one long run.
Well, the way it all started was that Mandrake and I had been working together actually on Firestorm.
Okay.
At that point, and I announced that with issue 100 I was going to leave. I was burned out on Firestorm. But Tom intended to stay. But then DC decided, well, okay, maybe we're going to cancel with number 100 for now. You know, and Tom was suddenly available. So I said, okay, Tommy's available. I want to work with Tommy. He wants to work with me. And we snuck around. We found out who was available. And the Spectre had just wound up on the list. And we said, give us that. Give us the Spectre. We'll show you how to make this work. And the key to the Spectre, because everyone, I had a bunch of people tell me, it's really hard to do this, or some people actually told me it was impossible to do the Spectre without either lowering his power level or falling into rote things, you know, like issue after issue. You know?
Okay. Like a Doctor Strange kind of, or just familiar
actually, territory? Actually, they referred to the Fleischer Aparo stuff. They said individual stuff is great, but you couldn't do a long run with it because it all becomes sort of like formulaic. And that was the feeling there. And I said, no, the way you do it, you don't change the Spectre. You need to have the Spectre to have all that power because that gives you the visual iconography of it. Why would you want to read about the Spectre if he can't do all these wonderful things, all these amazing visual things? That's part of the character. I said, the key is not the Spectre, it's Jim Corrigan. And who is Jim Corrigan? Well, when he died in the 30s, he was a hard-nosed, plainclothes detective. And the only thing we changed was that, no, Corrigan didn't come back to life as some of the versions had. He's been dead since the 30s. He's been trying to, sometimes, you know, he tries to fool himself and tell himself that he's alive, and that gets manipulated. But essentially, he's been dead all these years. And he was this very tough cop who was not above bending the rules in order to get what he felt was his job done.
Okay.
So by doing that, we gave Corrigan a real persona that we could play with. We made him just as important to the storyline as the Spectre was. And the story really becomes Corrigan's story as he changes from what he is at the beginning to where he lets go at the end.
It was a great run, and it was a great character. You're right, because they've taken away the Corrigan core of the Spectre, and he really has been unanchored for years now because of it.
Well, the whole thing, I mean, you could have... I had my chance to do things that I wanted my way, and other people stepped in to do things their way, and okay, that's fine, but I think you have to be true to who the character is and what they do, and it's about vengeance. That's what draws us in. It gives us that vicarious thrill that the Spectre will go out and get them for us, enact horrific eye-for-an-eye vengeance on the people who do bad things.
Have you been keeping track of what they're doing with the character? Because it looks like a new Jim Corrigan is going to probably wind up anchoring the Spectre again.
Yeah, and that's their right. You know, it's their character.
Sure.
I did my run. They gave me a lot of support while I did it. Whatever they choose to do with the character now is what they choose to do with it. I really have told my story. And if you don't own the character, then I can control what Grimjack does.
Well, of course. You know, yeah, and I don't even mean from any type of negative feeling. Right? I'm just curious, do you still ever read what they're doing with the Spectre these days?
I see that on occasion. I don't see as many of the comics as I used to because I don't get the freebies I used to. These things are expensive.
Yes, they are. But yeah, it's interesting. Are they? Do you think they're coming to a ceiling as far as how much they can really charge for a 22-page comic book?
Oh, that's a really good question. One of the things that bothered me about Grimjack in terms of the main series was I didn't realize that they were going to be charging as much per issue as they did. And I felt that hurt us a little bit, you know, among fans, people who might otherwise have charged it. But even your common, ordinary, any comic these days is running, what?
$3?
$3?
Sure.
$2.99?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and, you know, IDW, they do charge a dollar more, and it's a wonderful production. I mean, they usually do give you, it seems, more pages, and they add prose at the back. But, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I really don't even, I think you're right. again, I don't know if people would spend more than what they're currently spending.
The other problem is that a lot of people these days are waiting for the inevitable trade paperback.
Yes.
And they know it's going to come out because that's the real profit center in comics these days, is in the trade paperback. What you want out of the ongoing, you know, like out of the monthly book, is for it to cover the nut in terms of the cost to the artist and, you know, the writer and everyone else cost of producing it. But that way, when they bring out the trade paperback, the majority of that is, you know, like outside of paper costs and a new cover, you know, that's pure profit.
I got you. So let's move on to another DC title.
Sure.
And that's The Kents.
Yeah.
And a great classic Western that, again, I think, if not consciously, something must have gotten through to the producers of Smallville, because I think the timber that you've made the Kents in, you know, and the kind of stock they came from, you see it now even in things like Smallville.
Yeah, well, certainly, I mean, Jeff Loeb, you know, certainly, you know, knows his Superman lore backward, forward. And Mark Verheiden, before him, you know, when
yes.
they're putting it together, you know, Mark's an old comic hand as well. Both guys very good, very knowledgeable, and has made Smallville a pleasure for me to watch. I would like to think that maybe we had some influence, but the main thing that when I wanted to do it was to show what makes Superman the hero. And it has to be, it's not just the powers, it has to be the values that he has.
Mm-hmm.
It's the things that he embodies. He may be born on Krypton, but his values were formed on the farm in Kansas. And so where did those come from? And how did, I'd wanted to do a Western for years.
Mm-hmm.
At DC, and Peter Tomasi was asking what I, you know, like, and I told him about the Western, and he said, let's see if we can do that. And I said, Pete, I've been trying for years. God bless him. Pete found a way to get Paul Levitz interested. I originally was going to do it about Floyd Lawton, Deadshot, mm-hmm. and his family. And Levitz said, well, I don't think there's much money in that. Who cares? But what about the Kents? What about Superman? Pete said, well, John's talking about having some of the characters not be all that admirable. Paul said so. So Paul tossed it back into our laps, and once I knew that it was going to be Superman and rather than Lawton, that's when it brought it all into focus, because I started doing my research and realized, God, everything we know about the West, and, you know, I mean, so much of the cliches and all the things that we think of as being in the West was really Kansas.
Yep.
All the cow towns, Dodge City, you know, Wichita, Ellsworth, you know, all the great cow towns were really in Kansas.
Yep.
The founding of Kansas, you know, like it was the dress rehearsal for the Civil War. And then during the Civil War itself, you know, like the Civil War is what taught Jesse James how to thrive after the war. You know, like, he simply applied what he knew as a guerrilla to robbing banks and trains afterwards. And in many ways, he was still fighting the Civil War because the banks and the trains, you know, represented the North.
No, that's cool. That was, you know, and again, you know, both of you guys were so well suited for Westerns, and we've seen Tim do a lot of Westerns as well. And yeah, you guys really created a classic, and it's nice to see that, you know, what could have wound up just as an Elseworlds story is considered part of the canon now.
Yeah, I'm very pleased with that. But I'm just as proud of the Kents as I could be. Tons of research into it. You know, really, you know, there's so much real history in
yes.
there, and all fascinating as far as I'm concerned.
You know, no, I agree. No,
great characters. And it's fun. It Clark Kent shows up, but Superman never does.
Yes, and appropriately so.
Yeah.
Because it is. It's about the Kents. No, great story. Now I'm bummed because I blinked and missed your Aquaman stories.
Ah.
And I feel bad about that. And I'm wondering, while you were doing it, because it was close enough, were you aware of what was going on at HBO and Entourage and their
program? No, I didn't have a clue.
That's too bad.
I didn't know that they were going to do Aquaman on Smallville either.
That's, yes, and of course, yes. Obviously, you watched Smallville. What did you think of Smallville?
I thought it was great fun, and the fact that they updated it, they made him work very well. You know, like, even the colors that he, you know, which are Aquaman, you know, colors, they made it work within the fact that he comes from the University of Miami.
Sure.
God, they made him cool.
And did you watch Entourage? Did you ever watch that show?
No, I've watched some HBO series, but I don't watch all of them.
No,
Entourage
know,
just didn't speak to me.
But it was cute seeing, you know, of all heroes that they could have picked for a Warner Brothers film, it was funny that they chose Aquaman.
Yeah.
And they really took advantage of every fear that I think comic book fans have when Hollywood grabs onto a hero to make him into a movie.
Yeah, although it's odd. Hollywood's been doing overall a much better job in the past couple of years in terms of sort of getting it right. And when they do go off and do something wrong, you know, the movie does tend to stink at the box office.
Catwoman, perfect
Catwoman,
example.
Yes, Catwoman does does meow to mine.
What any specific ones in particular that you really enjoy?
I think both X-Men movies really captured the feel of the X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever differences there are in terms of the actual origin and stuff like that, you know, it's very true to the feel. Same thing with the Spider-Man. Very well done. I mean, just full of little touches that, you know, if you're the comic book fan, you know, like when Mary Jane in the second one goes, "Go get him, Tiger," towards the end, you go, oh, somebody there knows. Somebody knows.
And what'd you think of Batman?
I enjoyed it quite a bit. You know, if nothing else, I enjoyed the fact that they went back to, you know, really trying to do the Batman again, as opposed to how silly it got.
Yeah.
With the later film.
Sure.
I think Hellboy was done terrifically.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Hellboy, too. And it's nice to see, too, not just superhero films. I thought Road to Perdition was great.
Oh, yeah. Most people don't know that that was a graphic novel first.
And the one that just came out this month, or last month, History of Violence.
Yeah.
Another good one as well.
Yeah. Yeah, showing that you don't necessarily have to just stick with the two big publishers, that there's stuff that can be done from smaller publishers as well.
Yeah, I can think of one that would make a good film, obviously.
Hmm?
Well, certainly, you know, everyone's hoping the Grimjack will join the ranks very soon.
Oh, I do too.
And also, what about a Grimjack video game? Any thoughts on that?
I want to see it all. You know,
sure.
I want role-playing games, video games, Grimjack Underoos. You know.
No, I understand.
Action figures. I want my Grimjack action figures. I want a plush Bob. who you pull the string and he talks. Beer. Jan. Wookie.
No, I hope it happens for you, man. That's great. What else is coming up? You've said that you've obviously got big Star Wars plans coming up when the reboot happens.
Yeah. Of course, I can't talk about those.
That's okay. Well, if we can, we could at another time discuss them and you know, talk a little bit more about some of the books that we didn't get to, because that's the kind of creator you are. There are so many different things. We didn't talk about Heroes for Hire. We didn't talk about Martian Manhunter.
Yeah.
Is there anything beyond Star Wars that's coming up?
Again, I've got a couple of irons in the fire that I can't quite talk about yet. But some of them, I think, you know, I'm very excited about the possibilities.
That's John Ostrander. Make sure you visit his website at grimjack.com. Hopefully John will be joining us again when some of those new projects will get announced. That'll do it for this episode of Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening. This is John Suntress. Keep checking back at wordballoon.com or subscribe to our RSS feed and stay up to date on our upcoming episodes. Word Balloon is a copyrighted feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2005.